Blog Talk Radio.
As planned after troubleshooting some technical problems that have made it difficult to connect the program to you. And at the last second, it went sideways again. So I will just try to straighten it out for the next time. My goodness. I have to laugh because I've been sitting here thinking about these, you know, the picture of the eagles that are looking east and west. You've seen them, I'm sure. And it occurred to me what they are looking at. I'm sure it's not here alone, but here in Upper Canada, I'm part of a process that is looking to energize education for the existing membership, and I think it's a very courageous step. I noticed along the way, as I tend, as many of us tend to do, that the educational gap. There is an educational gap, just like I think, in a sense, that there is a generational gap. That happens when we lose track of the need to adapt, and it's not a value judgment. It is that as we progress, our roles, our competence changes, but we become a lot more frank with ourselves if we're at all intelligent. And we are making way for that new band of masons that's going to continue with the work into the future. The questions those masons are asking are similar, but quite unique to the generation coming through the door. It makes sense, doesn't it? They're the product of the best that we could offer to our children, striving to help them to gain a foothold and have a good life or a better life than their parents. These generations coming behind us are the first in quite some time that are not going to be able to aspire to the kind of lifestyle that many of us have just taken for granted. A lot of reasons for that, both cultural and economic. If we decide that it's all bad, then that, I think it tends to add a burden to the lives of our sons and daughters. that is unfair and unwarranted. The Mason of tomorrow will be looking at the legacy of whatever we've created, the good, the bad, the ugly, before they make a determination, make sure that if we're asking the questions and talking to candidates, that before we do that, we have some measure of the fellow before we start chattering away, chatting them up, as we say. We seem not to have done a very good job at that around. Seem to fail to mention that we're not a club. That it's not about coming and going as your time frame allows. Masonry asks something a little more. It asks a lifelong commitment. What would a young woman have thought of you if she went on a date and you got dropped to one knee and slipped a ring on her finger, telling her that this was now a marriage? Probably you'd be a bachelor today if you tried that type of maneuver. Disrespectful at least, eh? But in a way, that's what we see around us a lot. The men that seem to be caught in the headlights when they arrive and they realize after taking a series of obligations that this is more than a marriage. It's more than faith. We're inviting, asking, expecting a man to adapt a lifestyle. In all fairness, it's a big ask. Should he get into the questions about how? I'm thinking for a lot. I met a fellow the other day who needed very desperately to shut off the conversation, a philosophical conversation. He needed to get into business. And I don't fault him, because it is daunting. It's so much easier to deal with bureaucratic meanderings. It really is. But wrong person, wrong time, I'd say, to be talking to somebody curious about the nature of masonry. What the world probably doesn't need are more bureaucrats. What masonry doesn't need are more middle management. Where I am, we have 30,000 middle managers. And if you, the sad thing is, we haven't built our libraries here in Ontario. We haven't built our temple. So the influence and inspiration isn't there visually, which is a shame. It's like the epitome of the idea of arts and sciences to actually translate that through symbolic communication. We don't do any of that yet. So our incline up the mountain is a little steeper because of that. There's more to masonry than philosophy, but philosophies of a values-based organization, if they're not present, is not masonry. I've checked. So have you. You've taken your obligations, you know. It's there. The devilish part is why we determined it was too difficult to begin the discussions. Too difficult to begin the discussions. And I find that hard. Hard to accept, you know. It's just pushes that task down the road in a rather delightful way for us to address. We've reached that point where we can now finally address it. Oh, not without a bit of carrying on, but I think we both know it's inevitable that we add discussions, not this force-fed kind of stuff. I'm not a big fan of that, but more invitational. And I think we probably need to be a lot less stuffy about our work to begin with if we're going to help lodges develop. What's that? Here's a little bit of Duke Ellington to smooth out the rough edges here for today. Now, this is his version of Solitude. Brilliant. Thank you. Duke Ellington. Sit back and let me know what you think about this. This is commentary today. Absorbing the way. Accountability is knocking at our door again. It is louder and perhaps more persistent than before. So some care is needed before we show back or forget. How could the profane world possibly know except to ask? If we are collectively fortunate, those that respond will be reservoirs of knowledge, able to address the rational and irrational. Expecting an answer will immediately change popular opinion is too naive for an order as old and documented as Freemasonry. We are right smack in the maelstrom. Entitlement, exceptionalism, misogyny, white. Even more salacious thoughts are aimed at us. Always have been. How to engage the stranger about the nature of Freemasonry when it isn't clear in the lodge? Best to prepare by putting the question to the lodge. No? With a little imagination, a presentation to bring focus, followed by a relaxed conversation, might be a good way to prepare ourselves for provocation. Truth. Truth is the better anecdote. Whether it is about the pretenses or practices, you will know. A question is simply a question until you judge it wrong or threatening. Many of this team are aware of the effect of our own conceits have had on an exchange of ideas. Questions are just that, either good or bad, right or wrong. So when we answer the knock, we would do what we do with guests. Extend hospitality without being condescending. A comfortable seat, some tea, companionship, and comfortable chat. Visit. Undivided attention, listening, watching, acknowledging truth. Who better than one who understands superstition and ignorance is found in darkness? Are we so forgetful as to think we are immune to doubt? Is it asking too much to suggest we are part of an organization designed to anticipate? Proactive. The answer to that is no further than the cautions and warnings that play in our ritual. Absorbing knowledge takes time and aim. Whether we understand, we need to keep the question in context. Someone is curious, and unknown to them is talking to a man whose conscience holds him in his grip. I don't think we need to look much further for a digestible question than to think about the way we talk and the way we behave. We talk about hospitality and brotherhood, but many, many a time I've sat in a lodge alone, a stranger. I remember traveling a long time ago to a lodge in Ottawa. I was doing a talk there. And immediately, a very fine gentleman sat down next to me and helped put me at ease, as good company tends to. I'm very grateful for that gesture. And yet it was rarely repeated, unless I was somewhere where people had the idea that there was some gain by being in my presence or chatting me up. Always I look for the the quietness of the fellow sitting in the corner. I don't expect gregarious behavior. None of the ideas, the major ideas that I've seen have come out of groupthink. They come from the minds of individuals. If you're even in the company of your mates, ideas build a mind at a time. Maybe we'll find our way through this, but I think we seem to be looking in two directions at once. I think that's going to be a very hard habit to stop. Are we looking to the future or are we looking to the past? That's something a wag like me can solve, but it is an interesting awareness. Interesting awareness. Lewis Smith, this is from 1957.
Thank you.
any of you have had the opportunity to look in on the American presidential inauguration this week, you will have heard the youth poet laureate now being hailed. The tensions in that country being what they are, the words of a poet have been like a healing salve. I don't expect you to be healed, but at least to be in that effort at self-improvement, I think it's reasonable to think that we're going to be exposed to different, to an assortment of ideas and select for ourselves what fits with our personality and our interests, our ability, or what new opportunities may occur because you're trying something that you wouldn't have done before in your life. Going outside of the envelope of your own individual experience. Poetry is like that. Not only that, I lean more toward the romantic period and simply astounded as I tend to be over small things. Like, imagine that poetry, there was a time when poetry didn't talk about how a person felt. It would be poetry about objects, about events, epic events. And then how the poetry of how a person felt during those epic events, you know, something that perhaps would, well, it's not perhaps, it resonates, hadn't been done. And then we found the period 17th century, where writers were starting to express, 16th, starting to express the inner state of, the inner state. Here we continue that on Masonic Effects today with Robert Browning. He was a person as influential as he was influenced. Known for three parts of his work. My Last Duchess, which we had on the program about a year and a half ago, maybe a little more. The bishop orders his tomb at St. Praxed's Church. Don't think we've done that, not yet. And our offering today, Child Roland, to the Dark Tower came. They all show a considerable influence from the Romantic and the Victorian age, and that's the period that Browning was living in. They became famous in the second half of the 19th century. So this would have been the work that a lot of the Masons of the time, our earlier brethren, would have been picking up in Britain. Think of it like bookends. When you're thinking about expressing an idea, if you've not been exposed or taught, it's not to say you can't, it's just that you haven't been. And I tend to find a lot of men awkward and fearful when they're exposed to these different formats. Most of that awkwardness is about ego, fragile ego, and going in with preconceived notions of right or wrong. I'm not going to like this. I'm not going to like it. Well, it's not exactly the kind of open-mindedness we are hoping for when we bring somebody into the order. This guy is compared to Tennyson and Dante Rossetti. This is a fellow with some capability. Chug Roland to the Dark Tower came is a monologue, but it's not like the My Last Duchess or the Bishop Orders. It's not a dramatic monologue because there's no silent audience described in the poem. The title, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, is taken from Shakespeare's King Lear. It is about a pilgrim who is on a journey, to a dark tower. He's pointed on his way by a hoary cripple, whom Roland comes to despise because he feels the old man pointed him in the wrong direction. Nevertheless, after a frightful journey to which Roland encounters various creatures and animals and all other kinds of strange and frightful characters and scenes, he manages to arrive at the Dark Tower. However, instead of culminating in some explained reason or fulfilled purpose, the poem ends just as it begins in its title, with the words, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. The Romantic and Victorian eras clearly held considerable influence, but it appears that that influence may have exerted itself subconsciously, since, according to Browning, Child Roland came upon me as a kind of dream. I had to write it then and there, and I finished it the same day, I believe. I do not know then I meant beyond that, and I'm sure I don't now. Browning draws from the past, something which is very common in the Victorian era. Not only is the title taken from Shakespeare, but the entire poem has a medieval setting, similar to Tennyson's Mariana, in which the external surroundings reflect the inner emotions of the man. But rather than get in, this is too long, you know, it's too long to be for us to dissect it all here. So it's like we're going to just take parts, two narrative segments, the stanzas 10 to 14 and the concluding 30 to 34. And in the first, the young knight has just looked backwards toward the safe road behind him, only to find that it's disappeared and there's nothing but gray plain around him and in front of him. And he decides to continue since there's nothing else he can do. So on I went, I think. I never saw such starved, ignoble creature. Nothing throve, no flowers. As well expect a cedar grove, but cockle, spurge, according to their law, might propagate their kind, but none to awe. You'd think a burr would have a treasure trove. No. Penury, inertness, and grimace. In some strange sort were the land's portion. See or shut your eyes, said nature peevishly. It nothing skills, I cannot help my case. 'Tis the last judgment's fire must cure this place. Calcine its clods and set my prisoners free. If there were pushed any ragged thistle stalk above its mates, the head was chopped. The bents were jealous else. What made those holes and rents in the dock's harsh swarth leaves, bruised as to balk all hope of greenness? 'Tis a brute might walk pashing their life out it with a brute's intent. As for the grass, it grew as scant as hair in leprosy. Thin, dry blades pricked the mud, which underneath looked kneaded up with blood. One stiff, blind horse's every bone a stare, stood stupefied. However, he came there, thrust out past service from the devil's stud. Alive? He might be dead for aught I know, for with that red gaunt and colloped neck a-strain, and shut eyes underneath the rusty mane. Seldom were such grotesqueness with such woe. I never saw a brute I hated so. He must be wicked to deserve such pain. Only Dante, perhaps, has created such a sense of the imminence of evil in a landscape. But Roland meets no villains, fights no demons. The horror is stronger because of the absence of a living antagonist. He continues on his desolate journey. The narrative moves into its final stages with a nightmarish dawning of recognition. Burningly, it came on me at once. This was the place. Those two hills on the right, crouched like two bulls, locked horn in horn in fight, while to the left, a tall, scalped mountain, dunce, dotard, a dozing at the very nonce after a life spent training for the sight. What in the midst lay but the tower itself? The round, squat turret, blind as the fool's heart, built of stone with a counterpart in the whole world. The tempest mocking elf points to the shipman, thus the unseen shelf he strikes on, only when the timbers start. Not see? Because of night, perhaps. Why, day came back again for that. Before it left, the dying sunset kindled through a cleft. The hills, like giants at a hunting, lay, chin upon hand to see the game at bay. Now stab and end the creature to the heft. Not here, when noise was everywhere, it tolled increasing like a bell. Names in my ears of all the lost adventurers, my peers. How such a one was strong, and such was bold, and such was fortunate. Yet east of old lost, lost. One moment knelled the whole of years. There they stood, ranged along the hillsides, met to view the last of me, a living frame for one more picture and a sheet of flame. I saw them and I knew them all, and dauntless the slughorn to my lips I set and blew. Child Roland to the dark tower came. Notion about evil and a poem. Is it befitting? Another way of thinking about the world, or another way of thinking about our place in it. Yep, an album.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker. History. Just a taste. Just a taste. Nothing ponderous. A little bit here, a little bit there. Here we're talking not so much about your own history and culture, but the development of the history that became what we are today as an order. Did you ever think about Freemasonry as a complicated commitment? Did you ever think of it that way? It might explain why some fellows have such difficulty. For me, it's like when somebody tells me they don't believe in vaccines, and I'm thinking, that's part of my brain that doesn't work. It's like saying I don't believe in the sun, or I don't believe in copper. It's like, what do you mean? Don't believe. It is what it is, a fact. I know there are people that look at science sideways. Science is what intelligent people rely on. Knowing that science, it offers us the best and most accurate explanation at the time. Aha! So science changes. Well, yeah. So do you. So does everything. Is there anything around us that doesn't change? It depends how close you look, isn't it? The stone that was carved to build the cathedrals, thinking that doesn't change? Why are we scrubbing the effects of acid rain? Why are we doing that? Why are we noticing deterioration? Atrophy, I guess. You know, the law is there. It's a stated law. I don't believe in stupidity. How does that sound? Yeah. I don't believe in perfection. How does that sound? If I've had the perfect steak, it's there. It's the company and the flavors and the music and the atmosphere. Yeah. And I hope to be able to. I'll tell you a little secret. I have perfect days. If you want a perfect day, you need to be able to sort out what it requires to have a perfect day. Have you had one yet? How's that working for you? No such thing as a perfect day in your life. Yeah. Here, we'll talk about a perfect day. Back not so long ago. This is about, we're looking at the, not so much the excitement about new ideas, but the, when it becomes domestique, you know, when you have to settle in and do the, get into the fine print, living with each other. Non-Masons, here were being admitted to the Dundee Lodge, and it continued to believe that its freedom and privileges within the town were worth a considerable sum. The £10 Scottish membership fee requested was still less than the £16 paid by a working journeyman to procure his privileges and status as a master in the lodge. Entry fees were not always uniformly applied, and in no sense at this moment could the humble craft of Dundee Masons be imagined as an elite organization. All of that would gradually change. The records are clear that preference for admission of non-craftsmen was to be given to relatives of actually operative Masons. There was a predictably large number of such sons and sons-in-laws admitted to the guild during the 18th century. They could be of any occupation. By far the greatest number of new members who are not practicing Masons, but who tell us their occupations, are described as merchants, and also as clock and watchmaker, a draper, a wright, a maltman, an officer of the excise, a surgeon, and finally in the 1730s, a supervisor of the excise, a doctor of medicine, a shipmaster, a clerk of the customs, and most significantly, landed gentlemen of the county who bear the appellation denoting their gentry origin, honorable. They received the same freedom and now uniformly described as liberties and privileges. These admissions are by far the most interesting from the point of view of subsequent Masonic history. Yet the Dundee records, which at least tell of who and when, are silent about why a man was admitted. We might legitimately ask, why this moment and this particular craft? Good questions for us today. Why did the transition not occur among, let's say, the periwig makers? Given the destruction of the English records, we will never really know if the process we are seeing in early 18th century Dundee was indigenous to the Scottish situation, or an attempt to catch up with a trend being exported from England. For our purposes, it is enough to know that the evolution from craft to lodge occurred, and that to the process of everyday practices of a craft guild spread far away the working men who invented them. In every sense, power was decidedly shifted into the hands of the gentlemen Freemasons who took oversee the work of their operative brethren. Brings to mind questions about our own future, doesn't it? As we have begun trending. It's what we've been designed to do, you know, commodification and things like that. Sadly, the trend has a shelf life, and it's coming to an inevitable conclusion. Not so much the philosophies, but what it requires, I think, is an acceptance or a recognition, if you will, that we will be fewer in the future, fewer of us. And as the appeal, we're not going to see a great effort put in, and a remarkable genius step forward and change the way we appear to the world so that we inspire people to come forward. We're not going to see that. But those footsteps are going to be fading. Footsteps coming to our door are going to fade away. Some men, naturally, will be desperate and will have difficult time, as if struggling to find the life raft in the middle of a choppy, dark sea state. they're not going to say, "Well, that's the wrong kind," you know. Any life raft is the right life raft when you have that feeling of desperation, right? I think that's part of what's haunted a lot of people, a lot of decisions. That rashness. And then we find ourselves in being in an awkward position. We're not going to tell somebody. We can correct over time, but that's more difficult. So we move further and further away from the discussions, huh? Until now, as this it began in this program. We have this thing forced upon us. It's like forcing us into a good, healthy mindset. Forcing us to talk about theology and spirituality. We, in unencumbered. Mentoring has always been present in Ontario. It's just not been achieving the kind of outcomes that were needed or expected by the planners. The reasoning behind that effort is a disconnect because it was rarely here. It's rarely spoken of. But I would like to think, and I do, that each lodge will have its own chemistry and its own way of going about its business. Those that are healthy, those that are able to anticipate, those that are able to find the root of our thinking will do well. But I don't know if I feel awkward saying it, but the club atmosphere is fading very, very quickly. And it is uncomfortable to see the despair. It's obviously uncomfortable. It's like saying goodbye to a worn out pair of shoes. Education is not what somebody else tries to impose on you. It's you. It's me. It's not about understanding everything. It's about attempting to understand. It's like juggling all of those balls in the air at one time to think about the interplay, the mixture of chemicals, the mixture of ideas. And then being told that you probably are going to feel comfortable in your own isolation as you begin to understand, as you reach this point of enlightenment. I only leave you with this because I'm a Graham, and because this is my grandfather's book, and because Robbie Burns Day is coming up. This was published in the Scots Magazine for July 1803, and it said that the verses were found written on the window shutter of a small inn on the banks of the Nith, and they were supposed to be written by Burns, who else would write like this? Yeah. It's on the destruction of the Drumlanwood Woods. This is in sympathy to the 300-year-old trees being cut down across Britain to make way for a highway. And here it happens, where it's not quite respectful of our landscape. As on the banks of winding Nith, our smiling summer morn, I strayed and traced its bonny homes and halves. Here Lindsay sang and Lammy's played. I sat me down upon a crag and drank me fill of fancy's dream, when from the eddying deep below upon rose the genius of the stream. Nay, Slimblast, the sprite, replied, "The balls in the hair say fierce and fell, and on my dry and hailsome banks, nay, cankerworms can leave to dwell. Man, cruel man," the genius sighed, "as though the cliffs he sank him down, the worm that gnawed my bonny trees, that reptile wears a ducal crown." Seems royalty cut down the trees, yeah? From Langren Wood. Thanks for tuning in today. It's been short. Feels that way. I hope you felt entertained, and thank you for tuning in. Call out to listeners from around the world. Australia, thank you so much. In Japan. I want to make a call out to the farthest east, and to you boys from Denmark and the Netherlands that are back in Finland. Thank you very much. Good to have you with us. Canada, couldn't do it without you. And South America, whew, dynamic place. Here's a little Astor Piazzolla and Gary Burton. My way of saying goodbye to you for the week. See you again soon. This is recorded at Montreux Festival, Jazz Festival. Thank you.